Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, Eastern family. We're coming to you live as we get this point.
Hello, Alpha.
Hello, Alpha.
This is Charlie.
Well, that sounded like a prop airplane, but at any rate, thanks for listening. Yeah, thanks for listening and being part of the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. We've covered so many subjects over the past 5 years plus. Most of them are about the airline we hold so dear to our hearts, Eastern Airlines. For this reason, we decided to talk about the one person that made our company the great air carrier that it was, Captain Eddie Rickenbacker. But first, let's do some housekeeping, what I like to call our little kitchen table radio. Jim Hart's not with us tonight, so I'll fill in for this part of the show. We hope you will participate and board our beautiful Boeing 737-800 aircraft and be part of our show. For those listening to the broadcast on their computers, all you need to do is call us at 213-816-1611. That's 213-816-1611. If you were a younger person, perhaps you could do a tattoo on your arm with that number. And it will put you on my producer's board. I can open your microphone, which is your telephone, when you call in, and you can tell us what's on your mind or add to the subject being discussed. I'm sure it'll improve our performance. Remember, unless I have opened your telephone connection to join the live conversation, you will need to press the number one on your phone's keypad to join us. Those who cannot listen in on a computer can still hear and participate by just calling the number you just heard, 213-816-1611. Also, keep in mind that your telephone microphone picks up any noises that might be in the background, like the one we just heard a little while ago. So make sure you mute your phone or keep as quiet as possible during our broadcast. You might miss something very important because we test at the end of the show. Let's get Flight 263, or Episode 263. We like to refer to it as Flight 263. Let's see if we can get it up in the air. So I'm going to turn it over to Miami Tower.
Eastern Flight 263, are you ready for takeoff?
Miami Tower, Eastern 263, did you call us, sir?
Roger, Eastern 263. The winds are from the east at 5 knots, and you're cleared for takeoff.
Roger, Miami Tower, Eastern 263 is on the roll.
God, that sounds good.
Sure does.
Wish I was in the cockpit. Our show tonight deals with our favorite person, especially if you're a pioneer, that did so much for the airline we love. And it's about Eddie Rickenbacker. So Let's start the story by telling us a little bit about Captain Eddy. When Edward Vernon, his middle name, although referred to as the EVR, when Edward Vernon Rickenbacker ended his one-man rule of Eastern Airlines, he had compiled the most glittering record of any airline chief in aviation history. 26 consecutive years of profit, the last 21 without a penny of government subsidy. He turned over to Malcolm McIntyre, a transportation giant, serving 128 cities in 27 states over an area encompassing three-fourths of America's population and more than 80% of its industry. The 228 Great Metal Falcons of EAL were flying 1,400 separate trips a day. That added up to a 500,000 miles every 24 hours on a route system linking every major city from New England and the Great Lakes to Florida and the Gulf Coast, from the Atlantic seaboard and Puerto Rico to St. Louis and mid-Texas. He placed in the hands of this reputable lawyer, but an airline neophyte, the destinies of 18,000 men and women, most of whom had never known any other leader except the irascible, sentimental, strong-willed, benevolent tyrant they called, half affectionately and half fearfully, the captain. For a quarter of a century, he had branded his own image, not just on the airline, but on its people, to the point that out of terror or love, or more likely a combination of the two, some had been turned into ineffective imitators or equally ineffective sycophants. Like the fabled elephant being examined by blind men, Captain Eddy was many things to many people. The older employees, the ones who had been with him through so much adversity and struggle, looked at him with sheer hero worship. The young Turks, the Lethbridges, Halliburtons, Simonses, and Sharps, admired him without blinding themselves to his faults. And there were some executives so scared of him that they weakened their own judgment and ability. Steve?
Yes, Neil. Jack Frost was one of them. Normally a tough, competent man himself, he assumed all of the strength of Jell-O if he thought EVR was going to disagree with him. Frank Sharp tells of a time when Frost was delivering a plea for fare cuts before a staff meeting. He listed all of the compelling reasons for the reduction and the benefits to be gained, then turned unexpectedly to Rickenbacker, who glared at him from under those bushy awnings. "I think it's a lousy idea," the captain said testily. "That's just what I was about to say," Frost amended hurriedly. "In the end, it wouldn't be a very good idea." Yet if EVR inspired fear in some, he inspired devotion in others. Any man or woman who worked for him can testify to the countless acts of kindness, and most of them performed under pledges of secrecy and dire threats if the recipient let out a word of it. To Sheppy, he was not only a stern, demanding boss, but a considerate friend who treated her like a daughter or younger sister. Demanding, of course, was the universal adjective everyone applied to the captain. His refusal to recognize weekends as time for relaxation away from the office was the prime manifestation. If he worked on Saturdays, he expected every executive to work on Saturdays. This edict used to gall someone like Lethbridge, who finally conceived the perfect crime. Lefty knew Captain Eddie had a habit of poking his head into various offices, like a football coach making a bed check, just to see who was working and who wasn't. So each Friday night before going home, Lethbridge would clutter his desk with papers to simulate a work-crowded atmosphere. The final touch was to leave a pair of old reading glasses on top of the pile of papers. The scene he had set was that of a busy man who had just left his office for a few minutes to go to the men's room. For months, he worked his own con on the captain until Rickenbacker got suspicious. He called Lefty in one day and says, "What I want to know, Lethbridge," he growled, "is why the hell you're always on the John every Saturday morning." The contrite Lefty thought momentarily of such explanations as a terminally weak bladder, but decided to confess his dodge. Rickenbacker forgave him, but from then on, Lethbridge came in on Saturdays. Chuck?
Lefty became one of EVR's favorite, although it was hard to sometimes tell between the captain rode his favorites harder than anyone else. In that category, Ambrose Calbeck, vice president of maintenance. Rickenbacker loved him, berated him proportionately. Charlie Simons remembered the day when Captain Eddie would hold court and sit in Shannon's office. The deliberately various proposals brought forth by officers. Ambrose was a tough ex-Marine. Simons reaccounted. The old man really was really fond of him. Although they never guessed it. Every time Calvin would try to spend money, the captain would tear him apart. I was assistant treasurer then, and I attended these meetings for 6 months without opening my mouth. Rickenbacker would say, "What do you think of this idea?" Nobody dared say what he really thought, unless he knew that he'd thought, and then they would agree with him. My God, if it was raining, he'd say it was sunshining. He'd get total agreement. On one day, I recall so vividly, Calvin wanted to spend a couple hundred thousand dollars to put a system to work Simons. How long it would take to do certain maintenance jobs, like change a carburetor or put in new plugs. For some reason, he didn't berate Calvin, but as the usual gut reaction, instead, he went around the room asking everyone's opinion with, "What do you think?" And he finally got to me. I said, "Well, if I were you, I'd try it." "You really think so?" he asked. "Yes, sir." He took out his pen, scrawled out his memo. "Approved. EVR. You just can't predict what he'd do."
Is Jim Hart with us tonight? I was hoping Jim would be with us because I think Jim would probably have a lot of these memories that we talk about. But Simons once wanted to hire additional auditors, and he had only three, including himself, and they had to visit every station four times a year. And I was hoping Jim would tell us about those visits. I had a growing family and was always home, away from home, rather, more than a merchant seaman, Charlie Simons explains. "You don't need more auditors," Rickenbacker decreed after Simons made his pitch. "Tell you what, just go to the stations where you know they're going to steal." "How would I know that?" Simons asked. "That's what a good auditor would know, EVR assured him. The semi-annual staff meetings were a perfect reflection of Rickenbacker's management philosophy, which he once told a friend boiled down to, "If you grab them by the balls, their minds and hearts will follow." Actually, there was much logic to this. His method, he really was able to spot promising talent from the performances he watched so carefully. With his deliberate goading and feigned, sometimes it was feigned, anger. Bob Wynn, who had come over to Eastern from American with Sharp, King and Bateo, got into an elevator with Rickenbacker after one particularly acrimonious meeting and couldn't resist the temptation of proximity. Captain, he said earnestly, what are we doing wrong? We seem to be bickering and fighting all the time. EVR looked at him for a moment, then that seemed like an hour, and he could stare a hole through a boilerplate. He poked Wynn in the chest with a long, bony finger. Young man, the day I stop fighting with you or someone else in this company, it's because I've decided you're no damn good, and you might as well get the hell out. In truth, Rickenbacker seemed to thrive on an atmosphere of feuding. He loved to get a fight going between two departments, and the staff field meetings were ideal battlegrounds. George?
Frank Sharp, as Wynn had, asked him one day how he could justify all the internal scrapping that erupted at virtually every session. Well, other companies have expensive training programs for young executives, Captain Eddie said with rare ecumenity. I think our way is better. Look, Frank, we put names and even nicknames on those reports that I require in advance of our meetings. Where else can officers of a company know every man on the payroll, not just by the name, but by the nicknames and in many cases their wives and children's names? I force people to sit there and listen to the other guy's problems. I make pilots listen to reservations people. I make marketing personnel understand maintenance problems. This becomes a whole educational process. And another thing to stand up and talk to 500 peers is something else. I always can find out how a man thinks under pressure. If you're paying attention, you'll find when I get a new man up there, I always have a few questions for him just to see how he thinks while he's on his feet. At the start of every staff meeting, assistant station managers and supervisors were assured of receiving telegrams from the captain. The message in every case was identical. Your boss is now in Miami, and you have a chance to prove your ability to take his job, it would say. As a pep talk, it worked fine, but it also generated lots of feuds between ambitious young assistants and their suddenly insecure superiors. Rickenbacker loves stirring up this kind of internal competition. He once opened a meeting by declaring, the privates are now running this airline. They must be running it, he went on, because I'm not. All the vice presidents are here, so they can't be running it. And you're here, so you can't be running it. A Newsweek correspondent was once allowed to sit in on the four-day marathon. When each man gets through, he reported, he looks as if he emerged from a Georgia convict sweatbox, but he is then free to enjoy the torture of his colleagues. Don?
The Newsweek account offered excellent testimony to Rickenbacker's ability to undress a man in public. When one minor official proudly reported, there are 38 fewer delays, flights in January than in December. EVR demolished him. There were fewer flights of any kind in January, young man. By your reasoning, you could eliminate all delays by stopping all flying. Someone reported that pilferage had become a serious problem. College boys and other souvenir hunters were stealing seat-occupied cards off the planes. I don't give a damn, the captain declared. If any college boy wants to put an Eastern Airlines sign in his room, that's goodwill. That's public relations. By the way, and his voice dipped to his sarcasm, weren't you a public relations? If there had been a hole in the floor, the pilferage complainer would have jumped in. Yes, he almost whispered. You should start using your head, Captain Eddie snapped, tapping his head forward. What it's for? Chuck?
Maintenance supervisor brought up an incident in which a cargo truck had been pulled up alongside an aircraft. Cargo crew tied the plane's door to the truck so it would stay open, then forgot to untie it and drove off, taking the door with them. Everybody laughed, except EVR. It's no laughing matter, damn it, he shouted. I've got four pages here of things just like that. And these four pages will cost this company easily $250,000. What more? 90% of it is just utter stupidity and carelessness. The next breath he beamed when somebody reported that the commissary worker had suggested interchangeability curtains with the DC-9 and the DC-4. That's thinking, he thought. That's an idea worth $250 bond. See that he gets it. But in the next breath, he became infuriated over a report that baggage handlers were stealing chewing gum from the commissary. Because we used to get it free, and they know it, what the hell does it matter whether we pay for it or get it free? He demanded. It's not theirs. It doesn't belong to them. They can't walk into a store and take chewing gum or a bar of candy without paying for it. Let's get after this. I want this practice to stop. The allegory of this topical way of he feigned his arguments. He once got a letter from a dress manufacturer complaining about Eastern's poor service, meal service. Rickenbacker's answer was a question. Would you give a pair of panties and a bra with every dress? We're in the transportation business, the letter continued, and we'd rather not get into the restaurant business. Steve?
Yeah, the most widespread story of a staff meeting concerns the time he secretly ordered assistant station managers to deliberately tag about 50% of the participants' luggage to wrong cities. When the meeting opened, the room was full of unshaven and angry vice presidents, traffic managers, supervisors, department heads, and station managers. EVR got dressed up, and addressed the motley assembly. I just want you SOBs to know how a passenger feels when we lose his bag, he roared. A story not as widespread involves the manager of what was then Eastern's smallest station, Columbus, Georgia. When his turn came to speak, he followed the assistant assigned script. He reported on passenger boardings for the previous 6 months. His traffic forecast for the next 6 months, his general observations on how things were going in Columbus, Georgia, and finally a few items he wanted to get off of his chest about Eastern as a whole. I have a complaint, he began. I think that one of the biggest problems at my station is that we're getting too much mislabeled baggage that should have gone to Columbus, Ohio. Rickenbacker jumped to his feet, nodding vigorously. Son, you're absolutely right, he announced. While we've got some bastards on this airline who don't know Hartford's in Massachusetts, Dick Fisher, a top assistant to Frank Borman, had just joined Eastern at the time and had been assigned the job of setting up arrangements for the meeting. The funny thing, he recalls, was no one laughed at his mistake. There wasn't so much as a chuckle in the whole room. All you could hear was the sound of cheeks being sucked in to keep from laughing. Jim Hart.
Well, Fisher can verify how tight-fisted and cost-conscious Captain Eddie could be. He called Dick one day and informed him they would have a guest speaker at the next day's session. I'd like to have a reception for him in my suite, he ordered Fisher. Make sure we have all the necessary items on hand. Fisher had the hotel outfit the suite while the captain was elsewhere. The minute Rickenbacker returned, he phoned him. Dick, for God's sakes, what do you think you're doing? He bellowed. Are you trying to get him all drunk? Now you listen to me, young man. I want credit for everything we don't use, and that includes partial bottles. And I want to see the credit on my hotel bill. Fisher was one of many Eastern people who thought that the staff meetings, if they could have been stripped of the fear factor, actually amounted to an excellent management device. Years after Captain Eddie left, Fisher says, I was in the office of a management consulting firm and picked up a magazine with an article on what the writer called free mole management. It was nothing more than what Rickenbacker's staff meetings concepts were. You have to remember, he didn't like organizational charts and delineated areas of responsibility. He wanted you to speak your piece in any area. Fisher will never forget his own first report at a staff meeting. It revolved around his idea to operate the Martin 404 fleet as a separate airline with no food service. EVR praised the proposal, adding that we've already been thinking of something like that. Fisher learned later that this was his reaction to any worthwhile suggestion he hadn't thought of himself. You never really brought a new idea to Rick, Fisher says. He'd invariably thank you, but say that it was something he was working on before you brought it up. I've even seen some people convince him he was wrong, which wasn't very often. So he'd switch positions and adopt it as his own idea. Fisher once submitted a report on the subject of fringe benefits, how they helped employees more than high salaries, and that if you left Eastern for a better-paying job, you might wind up worse in the long run. It was a subject close to EVR's heart, and before Fisher delivered the report verbally, Captain Eddie told him, "You've got one hell of a good report there, Dick. I want you to get up there and hit it hard." Fisher was on cloud nine, but at this lofty altitude, it went to his head, and he began ad-libbing and extemporizing. Halfway through the largely improvised report, he felt the telltale tug on his pants leg. "For Christ's sake," Rickenbacker was whispering, "read it like it's written. It's better that way." Fisher survived so many staff meetings that, like other veterans, he began to grasp Rickenbacker's basic soft-heartedness. He blustered, castigated, scolded, and whiplashed to outsiders, and there were occasionally non-Eastern people present. The general effect was one of a man publicly humiliating his subordinates. But those who really knew Captain Eddie sensed the subtle difference between stimulation and irritation. He knew some of the younger guys were petrified, Fisher says. He could be very gentle with them up to a point. He could even be tactful when he had to be, and he usually recognized which ones could take a tongue lashing. Lethbridge agrees partially. It's true, the higher a man's position, the more likely he was to catch hell at a staff meeting. I've seen him actually go down a row of vice presidents looking for a target to hit, and you knew damn well the whole row wanted to go hide someplace. In person, the captain was tall and lanky. He never regained all the weight he had lost on the raft. He invariably wore blue shirts and blue suits, plus that crushed felt hat. He drank martinis, but there wasn't a man in the airline business who could hold liquor better than Captain Eddie, until he was in his 60s, when his tolerance for alcohol diminished. In his prime, even after a half dozen martinis, he remained clear-eyed and apparently sober. The only sign of over-imbibing were two little red spots on his cheek. This was probably just as well, because an alcoholic Rickenbacker would have been unbearable. As it was, he had a few, if any, close friends among his fellow airline chiefs. They generally considered him too boisterous, opinionated, and demanding. If there had been a tape recorder at some of his meetings with his industry peers, the transcripts would have required fireproof paper. Don?
Most of the clashes occurred at sessions of the Air Transport Association, the airline's industry for trade, where the captain would have finished quite far back in a popularity contest. And the feelings of some airline presidents toward him were very mutual. He disliked Tom Braniff and Jack Fay. Wayne Parrish believes he was jealous of Fay. He hated Juan Tippy and George Baker. He feuded internally with C.R. Smith of American, but as a grudging respect for his rival, C.E. Woolman of Delta, who would always get under his skin, for EBR hated Delta with a passion. That seemed particularly the way it was. He liked Bob Six of Continental, although they did not know each other very well. Six initially never got around to telling him that he had commanded one of the search planes looking for EBR in the Pacific. You know, I wasn't really close to him, Six says. I had drinks with him in Kansas City once, and I remember two things. He drank more martinis than I ever saw anyone consume, and I couldn't get a word in edgewise. With Rickenbacker, you didn't do any talking. You just sat there and listened while he held court. Six, no amateur when it comes to his cost control, had personal evidence of how Rickenbacker could carry the policy. Former wife of musician comedy star Ethel Merman boarded an Eastern flight in New York many years back. Anne this experience induced her to send an angry letter to Captain. It was pouring rain and Miss Merman got wet walking to the airplane as the ramp agent told her, "We have no more umbrellas." Rickenbacker's answer was polite enough, but didn't help matters. "Umbrellas are very expensive," he wrote, "and you are only got wet for just a few minutes." It was C.R. Smith who knew EBR as well as anyone in the industry. He used to infuriate the captain by calling him Mr. Rickenbacker. C.R. today remembers him as a very great American and a very sincere patriot. But the stories about the pair were still a book of their own. C.R. delighted in needling Captain Eddie. Rickenbacker once told him he was going to stop giving passes to ATA. "I don't want them riding around on Eastern for free." "Don't worry, Eddie," Smith said gently. "They're only trying to try Eastern once." They were together at a cocktail party reception one night, and EBR, in a surprisingly jovial mood, suggested tossing a coin to see who's the biggest SOB in the industry. CR shook his head. "Eddie, no mere flip of the coin could possibly rob you of that distinction."
Their paths crossed with relative infrequency, but when they did, Smith's needle was unsheathed. Jim Verner, a prominent aviation lawyer, tells the story of a dinner attended by both CR and the captain, Rickenbacker. Rickenbacker launched into his usual harangue about the country going to the dogs and at a supersonic speed. And when he finally ran out of breath, Smith sighed, "Eddie, I love you. I hope you live a year." Rickenbacker got along best with W.A. Patterson of United, largely because Patterson could get along with anybody. But even Pat fought with him at ATA meetings. On one occasion, Patterson had his fill of EVR's argumentative, sometimes abusive attitude. He had been lambasting the ATA colleagues for spending too much money on food service. And usually the genial head of United exploded. "Some of us wish you were back on the raft," he said angrily. "Guys like you make me wish I was," Rickenbacker retorted. Dorothy.
His conservative attitude toward in-flight service made him something of a pariah in his own industry. He honestly believed that airlines receiving government subsidies would be spending the money on such frills as filet mignon dinners. When he finally had to match such entrees because Delta and National had gone in for them, he complained it was costing Easterner an extra $15,000 a month. In 1949, he grabbed some big headlines by publicly offering to fly the routes of five competing carriers without subsidy, thereby saving taxpayers about $10.5 million a year. His targets were National, Delta, Capital, Chicago, and Southern, which later merged with Delta and Colonial, and he made the surprising proposal in a letter to Senator Edwin C. Johnson, chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee. Eastern Airlines Incorporated hereby offers to operate the entire domestic system of any one or more of the five above mentioned air carriers at a non-subsidy rate, he wrote Johnson. According to my calculations, the five above named air carriers carry 2,701,000 ton miles of mail in the above mentioned areas in 1948, and I receive an average of 4.45 per ton miles for doing it, aggregating 12,077,000 received from the government by them in 1948. His arithmetic was simple. Eastern was making money charging 60 to 65 cents a ton mile. What he was promising was to fly all the mail of his five competitors at Eastern's rate, which would have amounted to less than $1.7 million instead of the $12 million they were getting in subsidy. He professed great disappointment when the five airlines figuratively told him where it could stick what he insisted was a generous offer. And prove that airlines could be run without subsidy, he wrote in his autobiography, I was galled by the spendthrift methods of some other airlines, supported through subsidy by the people of the United States. It was infuriating. If we could make a profit for our stockholders, why couldn't other operators at least break even? George?
Such sentiments were about as welcome throughout the industry as a case of measles on a wedding night. Perhaps the definitive story of Captain Eddie's unpopularity with his peers involves an airline president, he shall remain nameless, who was invited to join a celebrity foursome at a charity golf tournament. She showed up on schedule and was greeted by the tourney chairman. We really appreciate your coming, he chirped. By the way, Captain Rickenbacker will be in your foursome. The president of that airline's face turned blood red. If I want to play with a prick, he snarled, I'll play with my own. And he stalked away. Rickenbacker, interestingly enough, had a dry sense of humor, which didn't pop to the surface too often. Someone asked him, do you think aviation will ever take the place of sex? EVR sighed before replying, it has for me, son.
Chuck. Occasionally, you seem to live in the past, as if nostalgic.
As you hear, we don't censor this at all.
Maybe. Occasionally, he seemed to live in the past, as if nostalgic or erased temporarily the problems and the pains of living in the present. Six noticed this about him. He was a tough old buzzard, been in almost every social conversation I had with him. He'd go back to his SPAD days in kind of a wistful way. Jim Elkins, a prominent Houston banker who went to Eastern's board in 1959. He later was to be instrumental in Frank Borman joining Eastern Airlines. Tells a poignant story about the captain using the glory of the past almost as a crutch, as Elkins described it. I had asked him rather idly about the RAF experience. I give you my word of honor. He talked nonstop for an hour at that high-pitched voice of his. It was like a stream of consciousness, starting with from the day that he went down, ending with the remarks that broke me up. As you may have noticed, since that time, I've never been able to get enough to drink. He told his story in a very dramatic, emotional way. He had tears in his eyes when he explained how he made everyone on those rafts gut, so they had a common emotion. The strange obsession when the stars extended even to wearing apparel. His battered felt hat began being the best example. He's always hated to throw away anything, item of clothing, but that hat was much part of him as the skin on his body. Johnny Ray was with him one day in EBR's Miami office and noticed this disruptible fedora couldn't have been any worse than had been run over by a Sherman tank. Ray knew there was no hat cleaning establishment in Miami, and he was flying up to New York that day. He suggested, "Captain, while I'm here, how about me getting your hat cleaned? Don't you ever let any SOB touch that hat," Rickenbacker shouted. "As Ray, I think it stayed dirty for 30 years. Dorothy?
EVR never really became acclimated to the idea of a woman working around an airline. During the war, he accepted them as a necessary evil, but in Eastern's early years, females were persona non grata in any position of even minor responsibility. EAL used to have a sales representative named Alice Eckhoff, whose territory was South New York Garment District. In the late 1930s, she was carried on the payroll as A. Eckhoff, so Captain Eddie would know he had a lady sales rep. It took a long time for EVR to get used to stewardesses and vice versa. He took a perverse delight in trying to capture them in some rules violation, and one of his tricks was to charge past the flight attendant standing at the foot of the boarding stairs, seeing if they'd demand to see his pass. He probably tried this about 50 times and never nailed one. One day, he boarded a flight manned by a rookie stewardess, Winnie Smith, who didn't recognize him. As he walked by her, he tripped and stepped on one of her $22.50 shoes, tearing a hole in it. Bravely hiding the pain, she asked pleasantly, "May I see your ticket, please?" "The good thing you asked, girlie," he growled, "or I would have fired you on the spot." Winnie Smith eventually became Winnie Gilbert, and she also became Vice President of In-Flight Service, EAL's highest-ranking women officer. Neil?
Some of his prejudices were on the ludicrous side, one of them being a distrust of short men. Lefty Lethbridge blames this idiosyncrasy on his unhappy relationship with Ernie Breech, who was under 5 feet 4 inches. Anytime anything went wrong, Lefty recalls, EVR would mumble, "Never hire small men." "We all smiled," says Lefty, "because about that time he had 4 vice presidents, none of whom were taller than 5'9". Travel agents were another pet Rickenbacker peeve. He took a dim view of this profession. And it was true that in the 1940s and early 1950s, a travel agent couldn't do much more for a passenger than an airline agent, particularly in domestic trip planning. For years, he fought the growth of travel agencies because he hated to pay the commissions that otherwise would have gone to the airline as part of the normal fare. He never got over this feeling either, although today more than half of Eastern's tickets are sold through travel agents.
The captain had a fixation on utilization of equipment. To him, the sight of an airplane sitting on the ground was the epitome of sloppy planning and gross inefficiency. This was true even in the DC-3 days, when what became known as the Jacksonville story became part of the Rickenbacker legend. There was a DC-3 in front of the Jacksonville terminal ready to board passengers for a flight to Chicago. They were just heading out to the airplane when they were startled to see it take off without them. "What's going on here?" one shouted at the station manager. "See the plane coming in for a landing?" the manager said, pointing to the DC-3 on final approach. The passenger nodded. "Well, that's flight 21 and Captain Eddie's on board. If he saw your plane on the ground, we'd be out of luck." The Chicago plane will be back in 40 minutes after he's left. The story may sound unbelievable, but more than one EAL veteran swears it really happened. Even if it was a cryptical, however, there was plenty of evidence to underline EVR's passion for maximum aircraft utilization, says Wayne Barish. Keeping airplanes in the air was one of the most overriding philosophies. If a flight hit Greensboro, North Carolina at 2 a.m. and was fine and his passengers didn't want to go out at 2 a.m., the hell with them. It was a policy that really hurt Eastern, but Rick made no apologies. He never made much effort to accommodate cities schedule-wise if this meant affecting aircraft utilization. He had the pilots with him. They were devoted to him, but it hurt sales and generated a lot of anti-Eastern feeling throughout the Southeast. Literally, he told the cities what they were going to get, and he didn't listen to what they wanted until competition came along. Don?
Parrish's word, resentment, is a thick, ugly thread that runs through the saga of Captain Eddie and Eastern. His good deeds and acute decisions were always being balanced against ill feeling he could generate without blind prejudice. Certainly this was true in Washington, where his open contempt for bureaucrats and politicians simply aligned government officials not mere towards Rickenbacker as well, but against Eastern as well. When L. Walch Prague, head of the CAB, Rickenbacker called and asked for an appointment, which Prague willingly gave him. The captain charged into Sharman's office and stood in front of the desk. "Sit down, Captain, sit down," Prague said with a friendly smile. EBR wasn't smiling. "What I've got to tell you, I'll say right now, and I don't have to sit down to do it," Rickenbacker snarled. As Prague himself related later, what he said practically burned a hole in my carpet. But he walked out, and my secretary told me later, he winked at her and chuckled. I guess I gave him a piece of my mind.
The captain couldn't resist getting involved in behalf of conservative candidates. Bob Six once commented that, compared to Rickenbacker, a John Bircher was a liberal. The late Senator Robert A. Taft was one of EVR's favorites, and he campaigned openly for the Ohioan in 1929 28, when Taft was battling to win the GOP presidential nomination away from Dwight Eisenhower. Rickenbacker's support led to an incident that almost cost one of Eastern's top pilots his job, Captain Mel French. French was an avowed "I like Ike" man, and he was at Miami International Airport the day Taft flew in for a rally in front of Eastern's hangars. A huge reviewing stand had been erected by Adelaide Rickenbacker, Captain Eddie's wife, who was in charge of the whole affair. French was due to take a flight out shortly, but he had enough time to appropriate an EAL tractor, which he rolled by the packed stands wearing an "I like Ike" sign on the back of his shirt. This was bad enough, but after he boarded his Constellation, he made a point of taxiing toward the stands where Taft had started speaking. "Eastern," the tower warned, "your hangar area is closed to all traffic." French paid no attention at first and came as close to the stands as he dared. "Eastern, get the hell out of there," the tower insisted. Roger, French acknowledged. He turned to Connie's tail until the triple tail was pointed straight at the speaker's platform. Then he gunned all four engines for several minutes before rolling away. Mrs. Rickenbacker, almost in tears, phoned the captain, who was in New York, and reported what had happened. You couldn't even hear what Senator Taft was saying, she wailed. At 2 a.m., a couple of mornings later, the newly elected ALPA council chairman at EAL, Mike Pinello, received a phone call from French. Mike, I'm in a little bit of trouble, Mel said in a masterpiece of understatement. He told Pinello what had happened and pleaded that Mike accompany him to a hearing in Chief Pilot John Gill's office later that morning. Pinello agreed after French swore he hadn't heard the tower's warning. In Gill's office, French again stoutly insisted he hadn't heard the tower's initial warning to stay away from the hangar area. After all, John, Mel said earnestly, I'm not some kind of a nut. At that precise moment, a loud alarm clock went off. Gill and Pinello looked around, trying to find the source of the jangling. French took a clock out of his coat pocket and turned off the alarm. It's to remind me of an errand I've got to run, he explained. Now, as I was saying, I'm not some kind of a nut. Gill had Captain Eddy's orders to fire the bastard who embarrassed my wife and the next president of the United States. But the chief pilot informed the irate Rickenbacker the pilot involved had been none other than Mel French, an EVR favorite, and explained that Mel simply didn't hear the tower's instructions. Privately, Gill knew that alibi contained about as much truth as Joseph Goebbels' press releases, but his own white lie took French off the hook. Well, that's about all we have for tonight about Captain Eddy, and there are so many things that he said and funny encounters that he had, not only with the Eastern employees, but mainly toward management, his own management, and, of course, the United States government as well. And tonight's information about tonight's show was taken from Robert J. Serling's book, From the Captain to the Colonel. And if you've not read that book, it is very, very entertaining. Any comments about what you, our host, our listeners, if you knew Captain Eddy, if you had an encounter with him, if you knew a story that you want to tell us about, we'd like to hear from you right now. All the microphones, which are your telephones, are open. And if you've got a comment about tonight's show or about Captain Eddy, we'd like to hear about it.
I met Captain Eddy one time. He came to Charlotte, where I was based, to make a speech. And in the receiving line, I got to shake his hand. And it was one of those benign receiving lines. And I introduced myself as an Eastern pilot. And that was the extent of it. So that's all I knew of Captain Eddy personally.
I got a story. I think I've told it to some of the people on the show. This is Chuck. My dad came with Eastern in 1937. He was a field manager. What he did was he went around and opened up stations during World War II. And then when they got going, they'd bring in a station manager, and my dad would move on. Before the war, my dad belonged to the Miami Flying Club. He used to fly biplanes and stuff right where Miami International Airport is. It was a big grass field back in those days. There was six of them in the club. And when the war broke out, they all volunteered to go into the Army Air Corps, my dad included. But he had to go back to one of his stations. I think it was Charleston. And he didn't hear from the recruiter. And pretty soon, all of his buddies had come through and said hi, and they were off to flight training. Well, my dad was kind of upset about it, but he didn't say much. Until one day, he got a trip down to Miami in one of those staff meetings that Captain Eddie had. And he went to the recruiting office and asked the guy there, how come he was not called up for service? And there was a sergeant there, and he pulled his file, and he says, you're going to have to talk to the officer in charge. So he talked to a major there in Miami, and the major says, you have a war deferment. Your boss got you a war deferment. And he says, I didn't put in for a war deferment. And he says, well, your boss did. He says, well, my boss is Bill Beach, and I don't think he's got that kind of pull. He says, no, this is not Mr. Beach. This is Captain Eddie Rickenbacker, who owns the airline. And my dad was taken back, but he went back and didn't say much. And then one evening, one of the planes came in, and Captain Eddie was on it. And then he'd met Captain Eddie several times before. And so they went into the office there when they were getting gas for the plane and everything. And he sat down with the captain, and he says, you know, I volunteered to go into the Army Air Corps, and they said I got a war deferment, and they said that I had initiated that. And he says, that's right, Frank. He says, there's 12 of you managers that run Eastern Airlines up the east coast of the United States, and without you 12 managers, there is no Eastern Airlines. So I went to the president and asked him to give you 12 men a war deferment so you could keep Eastern Airlines going, so we could keep the troops and all the stuff that needs to go over to Europe and keep our airline going. And we're going to need you guys after the war. And after that, him and Captain Eddie used to keep tabs of each other over the years. And I got a picture of me sitting on the knee of Captain Eddie. I was 6 months old. And my father's. So
yeah.
That was a great story my dad used to tell me.
Yeah.
Really nice.
Yeah. You know, go ahead, Chuck.
And by the way, like you said, my dad was very devoted to the captain. I mean, I'm sure there was things that the captain did that my father might not have agreed with, but over the years, there was nothing that he ever said that deterred about Captain Eddie's ability to run the airline.
Yeah. Well, have you guys read From the Captain to the Colonel?
I've read some of it. I haven't read all of it.
Yeah. I had the pleasure of having Robert Serling on my jump seat from Atlanta to Tucson, Arizona, where he lived. And he chose, instead of sitting in first class, he chose to set up in the jump seat, and didn't have a pilot's license, although he was checked out on the DC-8 with Eastern in the simulator, of course, in the L-1011, and a lot of other equipment that Eastern had. He wrote fiction that included The Left Seat, The President's Plane is Missing, She'll Never Get Off the Ground, and Wings. And some of his nonfiction books were The Probable Cause, The Electra Story, Loud and Clear, Ceiling Unlimited, Maverick, The Little Giant, and The Only Way to Fly, and This is Yankee 200. Robert Serling was the brother of Rod Serling, who was the host of Twilight Zone, if you remember seeing those series. And Robert, along with his brother, wrote lots of those episodes that we see on television. Still, they are still shown today. And when I had him on the jump seat from Atlanta to Tucson, very interesting man, smoked a pipe. And he asked me if he could smoke in the cockpit, and I said, certainly. These were the days before smoking was banned, but an interesting man, and he had just finished writing the book Wings, and that was a story of the flight attendant training down in Miami, and he had gone through the entire flight attendant training program, and he was certified as a flight attendant, an Eastern flight attendant, but a very interesting man to have had on the jump seat, and wrote some great books. And some of his books, of course, were movies like The Left Seat and The President's Plane is Missing, and a couple of others along with the Twilight Zone episodes. So fascinating people that really enjoyed Eastern Airlines, and he was certainly a fan of our company. And that's about all I've got. We do have a reminder here that September the 23rd, 24th, and 25th, we're having a grand old party down in Fort Lauderdale, rather. And it's the second annual reunion of the Eastern Pioneers, and along with the employees of the new Eastern, which we hope to have many turn out for this event. And it's going to be held at the beautiful Embassy Suites there on Southeast 17th Street. Beautiful venue for that reunion. We hope to see as many as possible. So it's time now to start planning. Look at your calendar. Put those dates on your schedule. Come down, and for $125, you will be entertained. You'll be fed. And you'll have a great time talking to other Eastern people. And we are honoring two individuals at that meeting, that reunion, Captain Bob Wilbur and also Mr. Vito Borelli. So that's about all I've got. Chuck, how about bringing us back down to the ground, to the runway?
All right. Eastern Flight 263, this is Miami Tower. You're clear to land on runway 27. The winds are light, variable from the west at 10 miles an hour, and the present temperature at the airport is 82 degrees.
Roger, Miami Tower, we're coming in and we're clear to land.
Great landing, Captain Steve, as usual. We had a great show tonight, folks. Thanks so much for tuning us in. And, you know, it's always fun when we talk about Eastern Airlines. And tonight we talked about a great man, Captain Eddie Rickenbacker, and also the place that we had the honor of working so many of our years in our career. And I just feel privileged at my age to look back and say, I'm in the Eastern family. We feel we've truly earned the title, the radio voice of Eastern Airlines, and it's all because of you, our callers, our listeners, our guests, and our host. And we look forward to our Eastern family and friends joining us again next week as we broadcast our 264th show, traveling aboard our EAL radio show, Boeing 737-800, I might add. Destination not yet decided, but we want you along to another beautiful Eastern destination. Until then, we all say good night, Eastern.
Good night, Eastern family.
We love you all.
We love you all.